Hello and welcome to another episode of Canada mit C, or in English, Canada with a C. My name is Annika Weckhinnes. I'm the project manager of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Canada. Today's episode is about Canada's energy policy. And the guest expert to shed light on this complex topic is Dr. Heather Exner-Perrault. Heather is a senior fellow and director of the Natural Resources, Energy and Environment Program at the MacDonald Laurier Institute, and a special advisor to the Business Council of Canada. She is a global fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., the research advisor to the Indigenous Resource Network, and the managing editor of the Arctic Yearbook. Heather is also a coordinator at the North American and Arctic Defense and Security Network and sits on the boards of the Saskatchewan Indigenous Economic Development Network and the Canadian Rural Revitalization Foundation. She obtained a PhD in political science from the University of Calgary in 2011. Thank you, Heather, for joining today's episode of Canada mit C. The interview will be conducted by Dr. Norbert Eschborn, director of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Canada. Norbert, over to you now.
The international image of Canada is strongly characterized by cliches. Bears, mountains, lakes, maple syrup are among them. But the more informed people also count energy as one of the terms associated with the country because of its considerable fossil fuel reserves. Would you say that this association still holds true today? And if not, why not?
Well, certainly we have the reserves. We don't have just maple syrup reserves. We have great oil and gas reserves too. So yeah, to give you some highlights, I do think Canada's an energy superpower. I think we have the fourth most production and also the third, fourth largest reserves, depending on how you count, of oil, crude oil. The only democracy in the top 10 with globally leading reserves. We also have tremendous natural gas reserves. I think we're the sixth largest producer, fourth largest exporter of natural gas. And then beyond fossil fuels, though, I would be remiss if I didn't say uranium, second largest producer, second largest reserves of uranium. And then, of course, hydroelectricity, other kinds of electricity. So yes, we are spoiled. We are blessed. Only 40 million people with all these tremendous reserves. I think why maybe people don't think of us as an energy superpower is because we pretty much only export to the United States. And the United States has come to take it for granted. And so we are not a globally significant player on the energy scene. It's very much a regional player.
Can you please describe Canada's energy policy from 2000 until now? Why and when have there been breaks?
So in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, we had pretty good conventional production, just like the United States. But we are also all seeing it kind of decline. Those conventional reserves were declining. And that's when we saw the spike in 2008 of prices, because a lot of that conventional reserves had come to the end of its lifespan. But at the same time, we saw two things. One was in Canada, the economic exploitation of the oil sands. And the oil sands is where about 99% of our oil reserves are. It's a huge area in northern Alberta, with, again, the world's third largest reserves. And we started to exploit those in the early 2000s and then really putting in a lot of capital, tens of billions of dollars in that high cost period, and is what is paving the way for us to be able to expand our production today. At the same time, the United States also exploited its shale, had the shale revolution. And so the world saw a flooding of cheap energy. Basically, the barrel averaged about $65 a barrel. So in Canada, I would say we worked very hard to expand our production in the early 2000s, trying to meet global demand. It was considered a security risk. We were worried about peak oil, peak supply. And then the shale revolution changed everything. So we saw a bust in the oil market around 2014, 2015, which also coincided with the Liberal government, the Trudeau government, coming into power. And they had much more of a climate policy orientation than an energy policy orientation. And so just unfortunately, as the oil sands were coming online, able to produce these millions of barrels of heavy oil, the Trudeau government initiated some policies that wanted to tamp down on our energy production and sees as inevitable a decline in demand for Canada's oil.
Okay, as you have been mentioning it, the term just transition plays an important role in connection with the energy policy of the Trudeau government. What does this mean and how do you assess it?
So I think just transition started kind of in international circles. I think you can find it in some UN, IPCC documents and that kind of thing. And the idea was that as we have this transition from fossil fuel sources to non-fossil fuel sources, we have to make sure that those economies, those workers, those industries that depend on fossil fuels are able to, you know, have a just transition, to transition to something else in a way that isn't, you know, chaotic or dislocating and very damaging to those economies. So Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Canada would be a prime example. Canada as a whole, actually. And so I think the well-meaning people, you know, let's say the global elite, took this, you know, that we were going to have a transition, but we were going to be kind and just to the workers left behind. In Canada, like I say, we did see an oil bust in 2015. And so 100,000 oil and gas workers did lose their jobs in that time. But that was not related to a lack of demand or to the climate policies. It was related to the shale revolution and an influx of cheap oil. Now we are seeing demand for oil return. The prices are going up. We're considering from an energy security perspective. So this is why, you know, the Trudeau government is still talking about just transition and trying to support oil workers. Let me tell you, on the ground, the situation is different. The bigger problem, I think, for the Canadian oil and gas industry, and in general, globally, is a lack of workers, that most millennials, Gen Z, are not interested in working in extractive resources, have been told that there is no future in fossil fuels. So we are producing more in Canada today than we ever have. It looks like there's demand for that oil, but we are having a hard time finding the workers. And so actually the unemployment rates in the oil patch, as we call it, have been lower than the Canadian average. It's around 3%. It's a very tight labor market. And there's not a lot of students going into, you know, the technical schools, the petroleum engineering, all those kinds of things. So for me, the problem isn't that we're going to have a surplus of oil workers who can't find jobs. The greater danger and probable scenario is that we're not going to have enough workers to be able to extract and produce and export as much oil and gas as our allies will need.
Since the outbreak of the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine in 2022, the concept of energy security has taken on a whole new, much greater significance for many Western countries. Conversely, Canada, is it aware of its perceived role as one of the world's most important energy suppliers? Is there such an awareness in government, business, and the general population?
So it's very dislocated, as Margaret, you will surely have observed, between Eastern Canada and Western Canada, because 100% of the production is coming from Western Canada. And the way the Federation works in Canada is that it's the provinces that mainly benefit from the royalties. So Alberta benefits, BC benefits, Saskatchewan benefits from those royalties from that economic investment, but to a much lesser extent that the eastern provinces or the federal purse benefits other than corporate taxes. And so there has always been some tension that in Eastern Canada and in Ottawa, there is, you know, a dismissing, I would say, of the oil and gas industry, its importance to the economy, its importance to Western Canadians. And so I think it has been underplayed. I don't think people out east are as aware of Canada's role. And I'll give you an example. So the Liberal government has proposed an emissions cap on the oil and gas industry in Canada, which would be so dramatic that it would have to shut in production, that we would have to produce less to meet that emissions cap. And I want to say that there are good faith efforts being made to reduce emissions and have been successful, but not at the pace that Ottawa wants to see it happening. What I don't think people appreciate how dependent the United States is on that Canadian production. And so to try to tamp down on that production without talking to the United States, without talking to our other allies, we have finally a pipeline, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, that will allow us to export to Asia. We have Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Malaysian partners waiting for that. To not understand the implications of cutting off that supply to our allies and to do it anyways, that does suggest to me that energy security, the needs of our allies, is not understood. And again, that there is just an idea that demand will fall so fastly that we will not need that Canadian supply. And again, not understanding the different roles of different kinds of oils, the heavy oils, the light oils in the global market, and the sources of different oils that we would rather have Canadian supply, even as global demand declines, than have to resort more to Russian or to OPEC supply. So I always say this, you know, Venezuela, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq are more strategic with their oil reserves and their production, their exports than Canada ever has been. And I think if Canada started to see it as a strategic asset and to use it to advance our values, to advance our interests and those of our allies, we'd be in a much better position. And I fear that in 5 years, again, as U.S. production declines with the, you know, kind of the shale peaking and then declining, it will become obvious that Canada needs to fill that gap as other democratic sources of supply decrease.
Almost 2 years ago, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck made a rare joint visit to Canada aimed at winning over the country as a permanent energy supplier for Germany. In retrospect, in the political arenas in both countries, Canadian conservatives saw this visit as an unnecessary failure, while German progressives saw it as a partial success. Can you explain the two different viewpoints and how do you assess the whole visit?
Well, I can, and I wanted to say this, Norbert, getting to know you and getting to know Cass spurred me to look further into the German LNG acceleration law and that visit that Scholz had in Canada, which, as you rightly pointed out to me, was the first time the chancellor and the vice chancellor came jointly to Canada and traveled together, the first time they traveled anywhere together in decades. And so that was an important visit for Germany, and it's very obvious at the time why they came. They were looking for sources of LNG. So they had the LNG acceleration law. They were moving heaven and earth, you know, at the federal level, at the state level, at the EU level, to, you know, to advance LNG import terminals, wanted to diversify the supply, obviously get off Russia, but also diversify the other suppliers, and came to Canada looking for it. And Canada knew that they were looking for it. And yet they had the chancellor come to Canada just so they could tell him that there was no business case, is kind of the famous line that Canadians remember. So from a conservative perspective or just a regular foreign policy perspective, that is embarrassing that if we didn't have LNG to export and sell to Germany, tell them that before they show up here. Why bring them all the way over here in the middle of what was a crisis for Germany when he's looking for LNG to say that we just don't have it? The other thing I want to point out is that we did have it. In fact, the federal government and the provincial government of Quebec in February 2022 had rejected an East Coast LNG project on environmental grounds. So as Russia was literally lining up personnel and equipment on the border with Ukraine, Canada rejected an East Coast LNG project, so there's obviously a proponent that thought there was a business case. There's a number of other LNG projects on the East Coast that never made it any further either. Why would it be seen as positive from a German progressive perspective? At the same time, they couldn't offer LNG. They shifted the narrative to, we're going to provide green hydrogen. And in particular, going to use offshore wind from the Atlantic Canada, which has historically been quite depressed economically in Canada, especially with the collapse of fishing and the cod populations, to say what we will do is we will turn our wind resources into green hydrogen, ship it to our German allies, and help you in that way with your energy security. Now, of course, there were no offshore wind facilities. Green hydrogen, as we know, is going to be very expensive, especially for a jurisdiction that has never done it before. They promised that they'd start exports by 2025 in a meaningful way, and I don't see a path forward for that happening. And I don't see green hydrogen coming down to a cost in the short term, before the 2030s, in a way that it can substantially replace natural gas. The last thing I'll say is there are some exciting new technologies that would see LNG, which is much easier to ship, much more efficient to ship than ammonia or hydrogen, that you could export the LNG and have Germany or the Europe or whoever turn that LNG into hydrogen domestically using pyrolysis, probably much safer and much cheaper to do than shipping green ammonia across the Atlantic. So a partial success for environmentalists because it was more focused on hydrogen. But from the perspective of foreign policy, from the perspective of economic policy, in my view, a disaster, an embarrassment.
From today's perspective, Germany's energy policy in recent years is seen as particularly short-sighted because of its deliberate dependence on Russian gas. Are there any reasons why this could be said about Canada's energy policy as well? And if so, what are these reasons?
So all of us, you know, looked afterwards, you know, and I'll say the average person never considered European energy security before 2022. And then in retrospect, could say, well, why would they depend so much on Russia? This was, you know, obvious that it would happen. And of course, you know, it was a risk, but it wasn't obvious to anyone. But so we, you know, so there's some condemnation of Germany for getting so dependent in the first place. I will say there is a real blind sight in Canada, the United States, and Europe continuing to this day about China, that the situation, the dependence we have on China is at least as bad as what Russia, as what Germany faced with Russia. So Canada in general is probably the most energy secure country in the world. Like I say, we have the natural gas, we have the oil, we have the uranium, and we have the critical minerals and the hydroelectricity, just enormous amounts. And yet we are pursuing policies, just like everyone else, to move to solar, to move to renewables, to move to electric vehicles and lithium ion batteries. The kind of the one thing that we would all have to depend on China to produce is the one thing that we are pushing, that we are subsidizing. And it'll be far more difficult if China invaded Taiwan. That's the scenario, just like Russia invading Ukraine. The scenario is if China invaded Taiwan, would we be able to apply the same kinds of sanctions as Germany was able to apply, as Europe was able to apply to Russia? And I think the answer is no. It is so much more complex, the critical minerals market. China's dominance in the processing of critical minerals is so much greater. And then again, with the solar panels and the lithium ion batteries and the supply chain for a lot of that, we are all continuing to increase our dependence on China for those aspects of our energy security. And I do not understand it when we are energy independent in fossil fuels and the West is energy independent in nuclear. Why would we pursue this path? So everyone is aware of the problem, but from a Canadian and federal policy perspective, in my view, deepening that dependence rather than trying to reduce it.
We have been observing in recent times what I would call a green hydrogen hype, both in academic and political circles. Is this really an energy source of the future, which can provide energy at an acceptable cost and in sufficient quantities?
So I would say in the short and medium term, hydrogen isn't great, especially green hydrogen. Now, Canada already produces, many countries already produce blue hydrogen, basically changing natural gas into ammonia. And we use ammonia for many, many different industrial processes. And making it blue means that you carbon capture it. So right now it's all gray ammonia, gray hydrogen, which is, you know, basically has the same carbon profile as natural gas. But you can turn it into blue hydrogen by using carbon capture. Now, what Europe would prefer and what environmentalists prefer is green hydrogen, where you use it from electrolysis, from renewable sources. So either hydro electricity energy or the solar and the wind energy. And the idea is that at those times when you have surplus wind or surplus solar power, that you can use that instead of losing it or depressing, you know, electricity rates, use that to produce hydrogen in those times. So that is the technological promise. The economics of it are not proven out yet. It looks like it'll be very expensive. And of course, blue hydrogen will always be more expensive than natural gas because your feedstock is natural gas and you have to do things to it. So you lose energy and you lose time and resources and capital in that process. So all of which to say is I don't think hydrogen in the near or short term is going to replace natural gas. And I don't know if it'll ever be cheaper. But I am still optimistic about the potential of hydrogen as a climate solution in the medium and long term. So if I would say 20, 30 years from now, I think we will have an established hydrogen market. It used to be that we never thought liquefied natural gas would be, you know, cost competitive. And now it's very cost competitive, for example. So where I am optimistic about hydrogen, first of all, is we will always need molecules. We will always need gas. We cannot electrify everything. And there are some industrial processes, transportation processes, where it will not make sense to use batteries and to use electricity. So hydrogen is a good high temperature burning gas that could replace natural gas, technically. I think nuclear power is they are developing some advanced nuclear reactors with the purpose of using that electrolysis to use nuclear power to create hydrogen. And I think if we can get the cost of nuclear down, the cost of these small modular reactors down in the next 20, 30, 40 years, then it could be a cheap source of hydrogen. And you could have it anywhere. If you're an energy importer like Germany or Japan or Korea, being able to use nuclear power instead of a feedstock of natural gas, or sometimes where you don't have wind, being able to put nuclear anywhere and turning that into hydrogen and using that for transportation fuels for heavy industry would really be a game changer for energy independence. And so whereas I'm not very bullish on green hydrogen in the next 10 years, it will not become cost competitive, will not replace natural gas. I think we need to keep building up that hydrogen economy. And I think in a few decades, we'll see something happening.
In Canada, we have the province of Alberta in the west, which is considered the center of the fossil fuel industry, especially oil and natural gas. And then in Quebec, we have another province rich in natural energy resources like hydropower. However, the impression is from the outside that both provinces are not working together, but against each other when it comes to energy questions. Is that impression correct, and why is it like that?
Yes. You know, not to be flippant, but maybe for your audience in particular, I have a colleague from Quebec. I remember we were talking about European politics a few years ago, and we made the point, you know, I said, you know, between Germany and Greece, you know, Germany is holding up the EU. He said, well, I prefer the Greek way. And so if you want to get a picture of what it's like between Alberta and Quebec, it's a little bit like Germany and Greece. So that's my impression. So obviously the Quebecers, they have incredible hydroelectricity reserves. They have the cheapest electricity, I think, of any developed jurisdiction. And that's been very lucky. But they're also coming to the end of that, that there aren't great as their electricity needs increase, as they do want to electrify transportation, heating, that kind of a thing. They're coming to the end of their cheap hydro road. And so they're having to look at maybe more wind, maybe more solar, maybe more nuclear as they think about how they meet the demand. So far from being, you know, the surplus that they could export to the United States, they are now looking down the road at having some, you know, supply shortages in the future. But I want to distinguish between Quebec's incredible hydroelectricity and how much they export, which is in the billions, so maybe 2 or 3 or 5 billion, and how much Alberta exports. And so last year, I think it was about $190 billion, the oil and gas trade that we have with the United States. I think about $160 billion of that was Alberta. Don't quote me, the numbers are within a couple, within, you know, $5 or $10 billion. So it's close, but may not be exact. But the scale, what I want to say is that the scale of what Alberta is exporting in terms of our energy resources really is an order of magnitude, a class of its own versus what Quebec has. Now, Quebec has this great cheap electricity, so they've been able to do more in terms of electrifying than most any other jurisdiction. But they've also been they have been blocking the ability of Alberta to ship its natural resources east. And so there was a pipeline, for example, called Energy East that would have gone through Quebec. There was no social license in Quebec for that pipeline. Would have allowed us, as an example, to ship oil to Europe and also just displace Arabian oil in Eastern Canada. Same with that pipeline, that LNG project I mentioned that was canceled in February 2022. That would have taken natural gas, which already goes to Ontario, and just extended the pipeline a couple hundred kilometers to go to Quebec and then be able to reach Tidewater. And Quebec, in addition to the federal government, rejected that project on environmental grounds. So Alberta is landlocked, and we have had no really great support from Quebec to be able to get our product east to global markets that want them. And we've also had very great difficulty getting British Columbia to allow us to get our exports west. There's actually two pipelines, one natural gas, one oil, that will finally allow us in the next 2 years to be able to export those products west. But at great cost, at great timeline, but, you know, kind of great political dysfunction. But finally, we're going west. But Quebec has always blocked our ability to do that to the east.
In Canada, the Conservative Party is perceived by many as the political representative of the oil and gas industry. If one talks confidentially with representatives of that very industry, one gets to know that these companies are not at all as hostile to so-called green technologies for energy production, and some of them are even quietly preparing to get involved in these technologies. Is it in this specific area, like in many other areas, that business is further ahead than politicians?
I absolutely believe that, Norbert. And I think, you know, we're seeing this everywhere. We're seeing it in Germany, but we're seeing the pendulum shift a little bit from the left to the right. And the harder climate policies are pushed on the left, we are seeing, you know, some response on the right saying there is no climate change, there is no problem, we're not going to have any policies, which is obviously not the right approach either. And I've been saying this, and I believe it to be true. It is industry that will hold that middle ground, that will advance climate policies and the energy transition, but in a way that, you know, doesn't put at risk our prosperity or doesn't bankrupt, you know, our companies. That they need to do it at a rate that they can still make a profit because they're businesses, but that they do want to advance this. And I'll always say this, the oil and gas companies, energy companies, are not in the business of producing oil and gas, they're in the business of producing money. And if they can produce more money or better money or different money through green energy, through carbon capture, through hydrogen, blue hydrogen, you know, through small modular reactors, any of these things, and they will absolutely do it through efficiency processes. So they are very much on board. Their shareholders are demanding it. Their ability to access credit is also at risk. And so they have a very strong incentive to decarbonize. And we are seeing a very vibrant, not only do they have the incentive, but they have the money and they have the expertise. And I don't know where else people think we are going to get the capital and the engineering and the logistical expertise to have this energy transition if it doesn't come from the companies that today provide 80%, you know, of global energy needs. And so we are seeing tremendous carbon tech, the oil sands, which are heavy emitting, there's credible processes to make it net zero by 2050. But there's also advances to use those hydrocarbons in materials, advanced material science like carbon fiber, or you know, other things like that. So they are looking at all the ways that they could possibly make money in a way that also aligns with, you know, our net zero 2050 goals. So that is one thing I wish people appreciated: the money, the time, the expertise, the logistics that energy companies are offering to the transition. Yes, they're going slower than I think, you know, most kind of climate activists would want, but they're going as fast as logistics would allow.
Anyone who walks through Ottawa's parliamentary and government district will notice the conspicuous aggressive campaigns of Canadian lobby organizations regarding issues of energy security and the economics of energy. These organizations from the health and the environmental sector are positioning themselves aggressively against the fossil fuel industry, claiming that the emissions are detrimental and dangerous for the environment and health of the population, while the energy organizations, lobby organizations, put their finger into the wound that neglected markets and missed business chances in the energy sector are detrimental for all Canadians. Which side is right, and is there ever any chance to overcome that kind of polarization?
That's a good question. And I think we've seen polarization across all Western nations on this topic. And climate has been particularly polarizing because it is seen as pitted against economic development. It is, you know, very strongly left or right. And then people take it as part of their identity. So people have moved beyond the rational arguments in favor of one policy or another into a knee jerk. If the other side says this, then it must be wrong, and I will oppose it no matter what. And it's obviously to the detriment of the Western alliance and democracies everywhere. And so do I see the ability for it to be overcome? I think, and unfortunately, what I think will happen is that in the next 5 years, we will see another energy crisis. As I say, when American supply starts to go down, when Chinese supply starts to go down, and yet we still have 8 billion people that will turn into 9 billion people, and a couple billion of them are going to move from low income to middle income, there will be growth in energy demand at a time when we are restricting growth in energy supply. And so when energy gets more expensive, I think we will have to stop being complacent, and we will have to stop being ideological, and we'll have to be more pragmatic about our energy needs and how essential energy is to human development, to our civilization, to a society, all those things. At the same time, people have to work in good faith. The climate crisis will also get worse at the same time. and people will have to work in good faith at ways that we can mitigate it. And I do think the energy industry is working in good faith. I do think LNG is a good solution to coal. And so, again, looking at these pragmatic, not making the perfect the enemy of the good, because we do need energy. We can't have all of our policies just do they contribute to the climate crisis or not. We also have to look at affordability, reliability, and security of energy. And we got a taste of that in 2022, and I think it will get worse through the rest of the decade. So unfortunately, I think only crisis is what will recenter public opinion so that the quiet majority, the moderates, look at all sides of the balance of the equation, which we don't have today. So it's unfortunate that it will take a crisis to get us there, but I think that's what will happen.
Heather Exnapiro, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you very much, Norbert.
Thank you for joining us for our latest episode of Canada mit See on Canada's energy policy. If you'd like to learn more about the work of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Canada and stay tuned for upcoming events, publications and more, you're welcome to check out our homepage and sign up for our quarterly newsletter at www.kas.de/Canada. Thank you, and we look forward to welcoming you back in our next episode of Canada mit See.